The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
We shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
American prosperity is the bedrock of freedom and security all over the world.
An obligation to the heritage of liberty and dignity handed down to us by our forefathers.
It's time for the Pro-America Report with Ed Martin on The Answer San Diego.
Welcome. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro-America Report. Well, I have to tell you, I was getting ready to prepare for this, and there were lots of topics I was going to touch on. I was going to touch on the infrastructure failures, you know, that bridge crashing in Baltimore, terrible thing, and also the fact that there's a competence crisis. I tried to call my local town court. Long story, but it was there was a friend of mine got a speeding ticket. It wasn't me, I promise. And I was calling the court. Incompetence on every level. It was incredible. I mean, double talk. Didn't know what they were doing. Anyway, there's an incompetence problem. I was going to talk about a lot of things, and I decided before I saw the news, I would talk about Easter and the preparation for Easter, being as it's now midweek in what's called Holy Week for Christians. And then I saw Donald J. Trump posted a video, not a short video, a long video, maybe 3 minutes, 3.5 minutes. And in the video, he talked about his favorite book, the Bible. Many people's favorite book is what he says. And he talked about a special edition of the Bible. It's the King James Version, so don't worry. But it's the putting the book together that Lee Greenwood did, the very famous singer who sings God Bless the USA. And it's called God Bless the USA Bible. And Donald Trump did a video endorsing this Bible and saying he partnered up with Lee Greenwood and wanted to sell the Bible. And it was perfect. In fact, excuse me, I saw Mark Krikorian, who is one of the leaders over at Center for Immigration Studies, a wonderful guy, a Missouri guy originally, by the way, and does good work and has been doing incredible work for a long time, highlighting the issues around immigration and the problems, et cetera, et cetera. Really articulate and really serious guy. So he said about Trump's sale of Bibles, he said, Trump is now a Bible salesman. It's almost too on the nose, and it was perfect. But here's what you don't know, I think. Most people don't realize. Donald Trump, from the time he was just a little boy, 2 or 3 or 4 years old, his father began taking him every single Sunday to what's called Marble Collegiate Church in Manhattan. And the man who led Marble Collegiate Church was Norman Vincent Peale. He was a pastor. And Norman Vincent Peale was famous from about 1935 until he died in the mid-90s, I think it was. Excuse me, mid-80s, as a great preacher. But more importantly, he wrote a book called The Power of Positive Thinking. And that book became one of the seminal sort of self-help books. It sold gazillions of copies. That and Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Those two books, and Dale Carnegie, another Missouri man, was written early in the last century, too. He was born in early last century. He wrote his book around the same time. Coming out of the Great Depression, there was a lot of sense, I think, that people wanted to know how to think about the American dream and what to think about what was going on. And these books tapped into it. But back to Norman Vincent Peale. Every Sunday, young Donald Trump, all the way into into his 30s, when Peale died, I think Peale died in the 80s, that there was another pastor that took over, and he was not as dynamic as Norman Vincent Peale. And I think that's when Trump stopped going to church every week. But for the formative years of his life, In other words, from the time he was a small boy, he did go away to boarding school, Trump did. So I don't know if he went to church when he was at boarding school. But whenever he was home, his father took him and his family to hear Norman Vincent Peale. And here's where it gets interesting. The Power of Positive Thinking is not a self-help book like Tony Robbins or a self-help book like all the gurus you know. It was a overtly and very prominently a Christian book. In fact, the earliest recommendations of Peale in the book are to learn by memory aspects of the Bible and to have a Bible and to read the Bible, but then also to memorize. Go through your Bible and underline all the places where Christ gives you power. I think that's one of the things he says, where Christ is speaks of power for individuals. And he says, underline those and memorize them. And throughout his book and his life, which included all this self-help stuff about up from your bootstraps. He started and then sort of revolutionized, made popular the whole notion of the Horatio Alger stories. He started the Horatio Alger Society, which the whole those sets of books came out of the 1880s and 90s and into the early 1900s, and they were all about individuals making it on their own wits. All the odds stacked against them, but they pull themselves up from their bootstraps. Horatio Alger. Well, Horatio Alger was popular at the time, but then he died in the early 1900s, and he was out of favor. People didn't read him. But Norman Vincent Peale popularized him and the notion of up from your bootstraps. So here's Trump all those years, the seminal leader in his life, the man who, other than his father, who would have been present and talking like that, and he's talked about him before, is this extraordinary Christian pastor who said you have to, have to rely on Christ. Through Christ, all things are possible. That's one of his favorite passages, Peale's favorite passages. And so when you hear Donald Trump, albeit a flawed guy, I don't know how to judge him. He divorced twice. I get it. I understand. But I also get enough about the psychology of human beings, especially Christians, that a lot of them are fallen. And a lot of them are fallen again, just like they're born again. A lot of them fall into sin again and again and again. And that the one steadfast point in a universe that spins is Christ and that truth. And so you can fall again and again and again and be born again. The truth is you can be born again once, according to the teaching. And even when you fall away in sin, you can go back to that you're saved. But the way I would see it, and I think the way Trump would see it, and the way Norman Vincent Peale would see it, is you're constantly renewing yourself. And the way to renew yourself is through the Bible, through the Word of God, and through prayer. And there you have it. So when Donald Trump in Holy Week says we're going to make prayer great again, when he says we're going to get back to our roots and have more people energized about religion, it's hard not to believe. Well, you have to really stretch yourself to believe that he doesn't mean it. And for me, it's easy to believe that it's going to happen, because that's the other thing Peale did, was he said, don't dream about what's going to happen. Speak it into reality. Speak it out loud. When you say it out loud, when you write it down, when you say, this is what I'm going to do, this is how I'm going to do it, you create a set of inertia, of energy in the direction. And for Peale, it was always Christian energy. It was always energy of Christ. And it was an inspiration to generations and generations of people. Inspired the country, inspired the communities, made a great, great difference. And my point again is, don't look at Trump and say, how can he talk about a Bible? Look in the mirror and say, why can't I? Why won't I? Or if you want to, say to yourself, I'm better than he is. I didn't mess up my marriages or whatever you want to think about the other person. And therefore, you can get there too. It's open to everybody. Christ's arms are open to everybody. And the sacrifice of Easter, the sacrifice of Good Friday, actually, and the gift of Easter, the risen Christ, is there for everybody. And one of the great pathways to it is the scripture, the holy words in that Bible. And so when Donald Trump invites you to get a Bible, maybe you don't have a Bible, or maybe him asking you to get one is going to make you say, I'm going to get one and do something more with it. Whatever it is, Use it as a chance for you, not for him. Use it as a chance for you, not for Lee Greenwood. Use it as a chance for you and your family. I remember someone telling me that there's nothing more powerful than a father expressing his faith. That mother is nurturing in a family and all that, but the father expressing his faith is powerful. And Trump's figure in our community, our America, is a kind of father figure. You don't have to like him. I'm just describing. And him making this a priority is yet again an example for us, an example towards us. And I have to say, I can't help but think it's so powerful. It's so persuasive. It's so perfect for Holy Week. So there you have it. I hope you have a good Bible. I hope you have a blessed Easter. I hope if you don't know the Lord Jesus Christ, that you'll get a Bible and you'll find your way there, and that you'll pray for me and I'll pray for you and so many of the folks that are with us in the Pro-America Report. That's, by the way, that's what being Pro-America is about. Not for broken pasts, not for errors, sins, but for the future and for the righteousness and for goodness. So happy Easter, everybody. God bless you. God bless America. Thank you to our team, Ryan Height, Mason Mohan, others on our team, Gwen, Carolyn. Thank you for all you do for our work. Thank you to the folks in San Diego. And we'll talk to you soon. Happy Easter. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Okay, sir. Welcome back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Our next guest is Dr. Jeffrey E. Paul. He's a professor of social philosophy in the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at West Virginia University. It's in the John Chambers College of Business. He has been a research professor in Arizona. He's been all over the place teaching and writing. And his book, which is out, and I have a copy of, and thankfully, Dr. Paul, I got a copy, hardback copy, which I like very much, which is makes me even happier to read it, as well as an e-copy. And I read it. The book is called Winning America's Second Civil War, Progressivism's Authoritarian Threat, Where It Came From and How to Defeat It. So welcome, Dr. Paul. How are you, sir?
Very good.
So I think this is a very helpful book because it explains how we ended up with this craziness at the universities, especially the universities, you know, and it walks through that. Give us a summary of that. It's over 100 years old, this onslaught of America, and we're seeing the sort of bitter fruit today. But walk us through that. I think it really helps people understand.
Yeah, the country was founded on singular principles. That by singular, I mean that there was no predecessor like it,
right,
in the history of the world, and has been no successor since. It was founded on the view that individuals have a right to themselves. They have a right of self-ownership, sometimes referred to as the right to life. But what that meant was self-ownership. And prior to that, in all societies, they were ultimately owned by the ruler, the sovereign, the emperor, the pharaoh, etc. So this was unprecedented, what was being claimed in the United States as the founding principle. So everyone was entitled to themselves and entitled to their liberty and therefore entitled to the fruits of their labor. That was what the country was founded on. It was viewed that individuals could coalesce and form a government for the protection of those rights, or the individual could choose not to and defend them on their own. It's more efficient to do it with a government. So that's what the founders did. They established a new government in the United States. And that view was the general view in the United States when it was founded. It was the authoritative view in the United States. And it was the prevailing view through the Civil War. And, of course, that view led to the Civil War because The country had been founded with slavery, which was a complete flouting of the founding principle of self-ownership. After the Civil War was completed and these rights were entirely secure for the entire population, within about 10 years, the view of the founders was completely rejected in one but significant sector of the country's institutions, and that was its colleges and universities. It happened abruptly and accidentally, and that's the shocking fact. What happened was American colleges and universities were not research institutions. They were just teaching institutions, pedagogical institutions, but no research was being done there and so forth. And therefore, no doctorates were being awarded. There were a few exceptions to that, but they were rare. So the American academics, the presidents of these institutions, felt that they had to be upgraded. And they had to be upgraded in emulation of the only country that had had doctoral programs for 200 years, and that was Germany. And so they decided to import Americans who had received German doctorates into their institutions and start graduate programs at each of their institutions. They did that. Effectively, that gave these Americans trained in Germany a monopoly over higher education. The monopoly was fine in the natural sciences and engineering and so forth and medicine, the empirical sciences.
Right.
But in the social sciences and the humanities, it was a disaster because the Germans had exactly the antithesis in their views about society and what was the correct set of political principles. They were the antithesis of the American founding principles. And they basically, to try to simplify it as much as possible, the Germans regarded nations as one would think of organisms. They thought of them as organisms in which individual human beings, were merely the cellular units, and right. therefore obligated to keep the organism alive. And to do so, they were to follow the dictates of the brain, and the brain was comprised of the faculty of these universities. So basically, individuals had no rights, only duties to obey. And most of the German professoriate were socialists. They called themselves state socialists. They used the German term for that. When their students got to the United States, returned to the United States, they couldn't describe themselves as socialists, which was an odious term in the United States. So they had to disguise what they were by adopting another term of description. The term they adopted was progressive. Hmm. And they got that term, they borrowed it from one of the German political parties, the German Progress Party. So they called themselves progressives and disguised themselves by using that term and also by giving a description of their position which avoided the differences between it, publicly gave description of their positions, which avoided the antithesis between their position and the founding position. They discussed that with among themselves in their journals and so forth, but not publicly. Mm. And because a lot of Americans began to study at universities and colleges, which they hadn't done up until the last quarter of the 19th century and into the 20th, that ideology, the ideology of progressivism, spread and infected both parties initially, but became acquired complete control of one of the parties in the New Deal, and that was the Democratic Party. And that control that it had over the Democratic Party spread from the presidency down to the membership, and so it now dominates one party. Some who are aligned with the original.
We were talking with Dr. Jeffrey E. Paul, a professor at West Virginia University, and Counter Books, by the way, is the publisher of this book, Winning America's Second Civil War. I think it's helpful to follow that path. But what your central thesis is, well, the Second Civil War is a war of ideas. That book you say, your book is about ideas. And the idea is the founding, you know, the founding setup versus this progressive setup. And those two are they irreconcilable? In other words, is it a war where somebody's got to win? They cannot exist in tandem, because they ultimately, the progressive leads to the destruction of the other. If you look at it backwards now, is that a weakness of the founding vision? Was it it allowed sort of freedom and institutions to develop that basically are undermining its very sort of central thesis?
Let me take your first question. They are irreconcilable.
Okay.
And in fact, I would describe contemporary America coming up to this election.
Dr. Paul, let me do something. I'm going to take a brief break real quick, and we'll come back and keep going, because I want to keep going. So just hold on. We're talking again with Dr. Jeffrey Paul. His book is Winning America's Second Civil War. Don't forget where we are, Dr. Paul, because this is an important point. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. We'll be back in just one moment. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Dr. Paul, but I knew we'd get a hard break and I'd get trouble from my folks. So the book is Winning America's Second Civil War by Dr. Jeffrey Paul. Back to what you were saying, if you can. I'm sorry to have interrupted you, that they are irreconcilable is the point. And go ahead. Let me make sure you finish before I follow up.
Yeah, they're irreconcilable. You can't have the rights that founders believe that all human beings have when the other side believes there are no rights, but only a duty to obey. There's no way of reconciling the two. And the history of Germany in the early 1930s and then into the late 1930s is an illustration of what can happen when basically such a view becomes the dominant view in a society. So I think we're in a very perilous position today, far more perilous than we have been at any time in our history. That's my view. And the peril has been increasing ever since the last quarter of the 19th century, and nobody knew or understood what had transpired in the universities, except for one man. There was a man named Herbert Tuttle, who was the most eminent historian of Germany in the United States, and he warned in 1883 in the Atlantic Monthly exactly what would happen. It was an exact forecast of what was going to happen to the universities and the country if it kept importing these Americans trained in Germany. So that's what I would have to say about that.
Dr. Jeffrey Paul is our guest. The book is Winning America's Second Civil War. All right, so what do you do about it? You know, I mean, to me, the most glaring exposure of the problem in the last couple of years has been the universities. And there's probably other ones, but it seems to me that people can kind of get that. But on one hand, it looks like they're teaching a system that's incompatible with America's continuing, you know, success. On the other hand, they are what they are. They're the universities where everybody goes and everybody is, indoctrinated. What do you do?
Well, there's the question of what you do about the universities, but then there's a larger question. Since any kind of attempt at reform, if it was successful, it would take several generations to be successful. There's an immediate peril, and I could talk about the universities, but let me just talk about
go broadly. Yep.
Peril and how I would address it. My view is that the Republican Party which is the non-autocratic party, whatever its flaws, it's not dominated by this point of view. The other party is hopeless and can't really be reformed this time. So the Republican Party has to get a majority of the voters, and it won't just get it by the kind of contest that we see transpiring now. It probably will get a majority. Trump probably will win, but we don't know that to be the case. So the Republicans need an issue which will automatically gain the allegiance of a majority of voters. What would that be? And I put it at the end of my book. It's why I proposed it. I worked with three economists, and what we found, if we supplanted the current tax system, the whole of it, the whole thing, the income tax, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the payroll tax on both sides, the capital gains tax, the estate tax, the gift tax, and replace it with a 1% universal sales tax. That means all expenditures, not just retail sales, but all expenditures of any kind, like all the ones that are made in financial markets, stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so on. If you taxed all of that at 1%, you would get more revenue than is currently being raised by the current system. And at the same time, individuals all the way down to the least wealthy of individuals would have retained income that is far higher than the income that they have after taxes today. And it would be enormously popular. Therefore, in the middle class, the majority of people who vote in this country than the current system. And if the Republicans took it up, they would get a majority and explained its effects, explained how it would benefit every individual who is now being burdened with the federal income tax. And so that's what I propose immediately. Now, I do propose other reforms of the universities and the Supreme Court and other institutions. But I realize that those are not going to be transformed overnight. And I also should mention that what the universities have done is they've corrupted the rest of society. That's why the media, 95% of the media is just like 95% of the academy. It's dominated by people from this one sector of the political spectrum that made its way into the country in the late 19th century. That's why you don't get a diversity of opinions on television or the newspapers and so on. You have to go on the internet to get a diversity of views about current news. So that's what I propose. There are things that can be done with public universities, and I think the federal government should not be giving any university, public or private, any support whatever. And it's spending a huge billions and billions of dollars on the universities today. That all of that should be cut off at the federal level. And at the state level, they have to require diversity within these institutions. Florida's done some of this. Ohio's done some of it. But it's going to take a long time. That's not going to be an overnight process. That's why I propose the tax that I propose, the universal sales tax, because it's something that can translate into immediate effects that would revive the original view and the original institutions that come from the founding.
Our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Paul. His book is Winning America's Second Civil War. We just got a couple minutes left. In the arc of history now, you studied this and you wrote about it. Are you optimistic? I know one of the chapters, I forget which one now, you talk about counter-revolution, I think maybe the second or third chapter. And just in your answer just now, you said it's not going to happen overnight. Are you optimistic that you can turn back this? If it's competing systems, one our founding, which was so unique and singular, as you put it, the other now this progressive one that we can at least see in other parts of the world doing its damage. Are you optimistic that we can win this?
I'm cautiously optimistic. I think what the Trump candidacy represents is a candidacy that's, if successful, will stop many of the, well, let's say, change the trajectory of the way that the country is, the path that the country is following temporarily. But that's a temporary thing. And I think in order to have the Republican Party acquire, nothing's permanent, but a fairly long-term, immediate-term majority, my tax proposal is the only thing that I could think of while the rest of the institutions are being reformed. And that's because that's going to take a long time. To reverse what's transpired in the media, which is just simply a mirror of the university, is going to take a very long time. Our corporations are being corrupted as well, because all the people who run them have university degrees. So there's a view that it makes no sense that there's DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in the private sector, but there is today. It's not just in universities. It's in publicly traded companies. And so that will show you the degree of corruption that has transpired. And everything that the current administration has done is, when you think about it, and set back, it's appalling. It's actually appalling. You know, they've financed both sides of the Israeli war. They've allowed Iran to acquire huge sums of money, which it gives to its surrogates.
Right.
And it's kept this open border, and it's done it deliberately. So,
yeah, it is. It's extraordinary. Unfortunately, thank you, first of all, for the long conversation. I kept you longer than I had originally agreed. Dr. Jeffrey Paul, his book is Winning America's Second Civil War. Everywhere you get books, you can get it. I'm looking at it on Amazon, just out a few weeks ago. Very interesting topic, as well as take on things. So we will watch closely and have you back again. And thank you very much. We're up against the break, though. I've got to run. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the Phyllis Schlafly Report, a daily commentary continuing the conservative pro-family legacy of Phyllis Schlafly. Now, here's the president of Phyllis Schlafly Eagles, Ed Martin.
There was a time when a debate about immigration was about jobs. There was the cheap labor argument on one side and the American workers argument on the other. The debate was also about assimilation of new people and how our melting pot is supposed to work. It was even sometimes about how we might save some folks from the oppression in their home nations. For example, Vietnamese, Bosnian, or Tutsi peoples. But today, none of those debates are the priority of the American people. All those debates pale in comparison to the greatest issue with immigration that's rearing its ugly head at this critical time. Our border is wide open, and we are watching as millions of people come to America. They are lying about their reasons for coming to our border. In order to get status and be admitted, they are taught to say specific words, words like fear and refuge from harm. And our broken Biden government is letting them in because of a broken asylum system. Today, the border question is about self-defense. It's all about our national security. The people coming are unknowable, and many fit a negative profile. They are mostly single men of military age who are coming in droves, not the happy Hispanic families who we are propagandized to believe are coming to America. It's time to stop it all, and stop it right now. But first, we have to understand exactly what's happening. To do that, I recently sought and spoke to Todd Benzman. He's an expert on the problems at the border. He's a senior national security fellow at the Center for Immigration Studies. He's a thoughtful man and serious and an investigator. And he's written two books that lay bare the problems. One is called America's Covert Border War, and the other is called Overrun. The books describe exactly what's happening at our border, and it's about national security. This has become the number one issue in America, our border and what it's doing to America. And it's time for all of us to understand what's happening and to make Washington stop the insanity.
This has been the Phyllis Schlafly Report from Phyllis Schlafly Eagles. America is safe only when America is strong. Our national defense requires the most modern technology and best-trained soldiers, and there should be no social politics or idle threats coming out of Washington. At PhyllisSchlafly.com, we take this work very seriously. Please visit PhyllisSchlafly.com. Thanks for listening, and join us again for the Phyllis Schlafly Report.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Ed Martin here on a Pro America Report. Hey, wrapping things up, this is what you need to do today, because this is an important topic. And I don't really have as good an action item for this as I like. Sometimes you say, you know, call so-and-so, show up at such-and-such, you know, read this, you know, do that, vote this way. Sometimes it's more specific. This is a broader slightly, but I have to tell you, the persecution of Jeff Clark is such a black eye on this country. Jeff Clark has a bar complaint against him from the DC, the District of Columbia Bar Association. And they have an unwritten rule, the DC bar, because you can imagine the DC bar. There's a lot of lawyers that work in the government that the DC bar, you know, it would have the jurisdiction over in some sense. Many of them would be practicing law and be D.C. bar members. Then they become attorney general or associate attorney general, or they become the general counsel to the Department of Homeland Security, whatever it is. And if it were possible for any single person to file a complaint against a D.C. bar, you know, a lawyer in the D.C. bar, you'd have complaints all the time, right? If you're a Democrat and you hate the Republican administration, you'd file a bar complaint, all that. So the D.C. bar has had a rule, an unwritten rule. It's difficult to imagine how you'd make it codify it formally. But the unwritten rule was basically, if you don't have personal knowledge, firsthand knowledge of conduct, you can't file a bar complaint about it. Right. So you can't be, you know, living in Missouri and you say, the attorney general just did something I don't like. I'm going to file a bar complaint against him and file it. Because generally, when you file a bar complaint, you're allowed to file it without any. There's no cost. There's no penalty if it's deemed that it was not valid. So it's wide open for the citizens to say, hey, I live in Missouri. I'm in St. Louis, and I see this lawyer. He acted badly. I file a bar complaint against him. I want people to know. The bar would look into it. The Missouri bar. D.C. said, look, we're not going to have it so that every time somebody hates what the attorney general does or the general counsel somewhere, that there's bar complaints. So you have to have personal, firsthand knowledge of the conduct. Well, in the case of Jeff Clark, the complaints against him were that he was advising his client, the president of the United States, about what possible legal options he had, which is what lawyers do. In fact, lawyers come up with as many different scenarios as they can possibly imagine as a way to manage or understand risk. So when you're sitting with a client, you say, well, it could go like this. It could go like that. There could be these facts. There could be this, that. They could use this law. They could try that law. You could have this judge. You have to take a whole bunch of factors in place. You have to take them into account to manage risk and make decisions about it. So Jeff Clark, by the nature of his job, very senior in the Department of Justice, a guy who had served in the highest levels of the Bush administration, W. Bush, and had been practicing law, Harvard graduate. He'd been practicing law, well-respected. He's now advising President Trump, who's trying to figure out what happened with this election, where tens of millions of Americans felt like and still feel it didn't go the way it seemed to be headed. There were things that happened that did not seem to be normal in the way elections work, stopping in the middle of the night and all these things. And so as a good lawyer, you're giving all the different options. And some of the options were you could stop things this way. You could go forward that way. You could just take it the way it's going. All the different options. A good advocare, the root, Latin root, give voice, to give voice to. A good advocate is going to give voice to all the different theories, all the ideas, all the things that were going on. And suddenly, because there was this massive effort to make it so no one would ever question the election of 2020, you should be afraid. You'll be sued by Dominion or others if you're saying the wrong things. If you're, and you'll settle if you're Fox News because you're worried about it. And if you're a lawyer, You got left-wingers, Democrats, not even left-wingers, Democrats, who say we can't upset the status quo, which is that we're not going to allow questioning. We're not going to have auditable elections. So go after all these different lawyers, whether it's Dean Eastman or Jeff Clark or Rudy Giuliani or Sidney Powell or any of them. 60, they had a project called the Project 65. And here's the point. Jeff Clark has had an illustrious career, and the D.C. bar next week will start a bar trial against him for being a good lawyer and a smart lawyer. And a lawyer who cares, and a lawyer who represents his client, a lawyer who is an advocate. And the two things that I deeply, deeply regret is that the D.C. bar is doing this at all, but also that there's not more lawyers saying out loud, this isn't right. This shouldn't happen. You could disagree vehemently. You could even tell all your friends you could never hire Jeff Clark. He recommended this. That's not a theory. But you cannot use the bar and the license as lawfare against individuals doing their jobs, doing what they're hired to do. There's no allegation of criminal conduct. The D.C. bar is not talking about criminal conduct. They're not allowed to. And the most despicable part about it, by the way, is in this case, the D.C. bar could not have a first person account because the people in the room were Donald Trump and Jeff Clark, maybe a few others. And instead, they accepted a letter from Senator Dick Durbin, Illinois Democrat, partisan, saying, oh, yeah, we got a problem. You got to look at this. And they used that as a complaint and they broke their norms. Their norms that said, we're not going to do these, you know, third party. I think something was really rotten. Please do something about it. They said, oh, in this case, Senator Durbin's got a senior position in the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're going to let him do to make this objection. And we're going to use it as a basis to punish Jeff Clark. So the to do is pray for Jeff Clark. He's a faithful guy. Find a way to track this story. I don't think Jeff has put out much request for a legal defense fund. But if he does, we'll make sure to put that out there because it's costing him a lot of money. And demand that people do the right thing and stop this madness. Anyway, that's all I've got. Jeff Clark, what a good guy. We got to go. Thank you, Ryan Height, Mason Mohan. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. It's Ed Martin here on the Pro America Report. Talk to you then.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.